there. Welcome to this episode of Just the Discs. My name is Brian Sauer. This is a podcast about Blu-rays. This week, I am going Kino-centric again. They always put out a ton of stuff every month, and I do my best to try and keep you folks abreast of what they're doing, all the good stuff they're putting out. And so I have made a little pile of 5 discs from August and September that I am really pretty excited about. They're all kind of in the dramatic area. So drama was the thing that'll tie these together, I guess. But regardless, they're just good movies. So first up, we have They Shoot Horses, Don't They? From 1969.
Easy come.
People are the ultimate spectacle.
And now...
out of here, over broken bodies and broken dreams, carrying the grand prize of $1,500 silver dollars. And believe me, these wonderful kids deserve your cheers, because each one of them is fighting down pain, exhaustion, weariness, struggling to keep going, battling to win. And isn't that the American way? You bet it is.
What I mean is, if you think about it, cattle ain't got it much worse than us.
She ain't pregnant. I'm Nelson Eddy.
So what's healthier than having a kid?
Number 78 is in trouble. We got a poor judge over there. One.
What are you going to do? Put us in cages and let him throw peanuts at us?
The boy from 67 is down. He is definitely down.
Look at us. We're all like this now. Dirty. Swollen feet. No sleep. What do you want?
And I just talked about Sidney Pollack recently with Castle Keep, which came out from Indicator. And this is also a Sidney Pollack movie. I think it was like his 4th movie, but sometimes I kind of think of it as his 1st movie. I mean, that's not really fair. I mean, he certainly has made some good films before this, but this is the one that always got my attention in a big way in terms of his career for me. And I know P.T. Anderson is a big fan of this one. I mentioned it on... I feel like Pure Cinema, maybe. Oh, you know what? Maybe it was only on a Patreon episode. I don't know. But regardless, P.T. Anderson's a big fan of this one. The basic story, I'll just read the back here. Screen legend Jane Fonda stars in this vivid, fascinating film as a woman driven to seize her last best chance during the very worst times. A brilliant achievement by director Sidney Pollack. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Is a stunning period piece recognized as one of the most highly acclaimed films of all time. In Depression-era America, desperation spawned a bizarre fad, the dance marathon, where couples competed to stay on their feet for thousands of hours, and audiences flocked to watch. But Gloria, Jane Fonda, doesn't think of herself as a spectacle. She is a fierce, unforgiving contestant in a battle she's determined to win. At stake is much more than the $1,500 prize. The event is her only hope for dignity, accomplishment, and salvation. The stellar cast includes Michael Sarrazin, Susanna York, Gig Young, Red Buttons, Bonnie Bedelia. She was Bruce Willis's wife in Die Hard. Bruce Dern, Michael Conrad, and Al Lewis, who was Grandpa on the Munsters. Nominated for 9 Academy Awards, including Best Actress for Fonda, Supporting Actress for Susanna York, Director for Pollack, Screenplay, and winner of Best Actor in a Supporting Role for Gig Young.
My old man never got out of the 4th grade. But when it came to people, he didn't know his ass from his elbow. You know what he was? He was a faith healer. I used to travel the circuit with him. I was the one he healed. I was his shill to get the crowd set up. Walk. My boy, when I lay my hand on you, you will walk. You will walk. That sodden old bastard. He thought it was him they believed in. But it was me.
So yeah, like I was saying, P.T. Anderson likes this movie, and he shot a music video, I think, for Michael Penn. It's just down a long hallway, and it's, I think he said it was the longest hallway in the valley or something. So literally, the camera, I feel like, is moving down the hallway the whole time, and things are rushing past the camera. And one thing he rushes past the camera is a group of people that are dressed exactly as the dance marathon people in They Shoot Horses, Don't They? So he likes this movie a lot, and I can see why. It's really powerful stuff. From the very first scene, the movie makes no bones about the fact that it's not going to be an upbeat story. And just the idea of a dance marathon is pretty... horrifying is not the right word, but it's pretty messed up, you know? It's just the idea that in the Depression era, people would come and watch other people be miserable, basically, is an interesting thing to me. You know, you genuinely start to feel the exhaustion as you watch the movie.
You want to sleep some?
No, I'm too tired to sleep.
Sailor says you gotta go a long time, maybe 500 hours before you can get so you can sleep while you're still moving. You look tired.
No kidding.
Why don't you try sleeping on my shoulder? I won't let you slip. You can trust me.
That's what the last guy said.
What?
Forget it.
But that's not to say that it's boring. You feel it in an engaging way. You are emotionally tied into it. It's funny because the movie is about dancing, which should be romantic, but the act itself of dancing is not really romantic here. It's just, you know, robotic. It's, I mean, we're talking like thousands of hours of dancing, and they get little breaks, and so they're not dancing all the time, but it is kind of like a modern day elimination reality television kind of scenario. You know, each couple that drops out, you get closer and closer to winning the $1,500 silver dollars. That they make a big point of that. But yeah, so it's a bit of a downbeat film, but it is really powerful stuff, and I am a big, big, big fan of it. And this new Blu-ray looks great. I should say the film was shot by Philip Lathrop, who also shot Point Blank, among many other things. So, in theory, it looks good, on DVD at least, but the DVD transfers I saw prior to this were not so hot. This Blu-ray looks very good, in my opinion, and folks should definitely pick it up if you're wary of another subpar transfer. This one looks like some care has clearly been taken. Like, I would actually call this, between the transfer and the extras, a Criterion-level release, you know, that is definitely worthy of being picked up. One quick interesting thing about the movie is that it was Jane Fonda's first serious role. She had done several movies before this. In fact, she had just done Barbarella, basically was coming off of that. And so this is a real change of pace for her. She was nominated, I believe, for this, and then would win the Academy Award in 71 for Clute. So she was really finding her way as a dramatic actress. And she's very effective in this movie. She's very angry, basically, from the word go, but that is not necessarily a bad thing. She's been put in a rough spot, so you kind of feel what brought her to where she is and why she's so angry, and the moments when she's a little softer are that much more effective. And so she does a good job here, and I think part of that is and should be credited to director Sidney Pollack, who, like I said, I like him a lot, and I like his films a lot. And this late 60s, 70s work is some of my favorite stuff. He's just a great director.
There is something in every film by any director that by which you can recognize that director, I think. And sometimes I think that there's a kind of melancholy in mine. I don't know why, but it's what I see in them. I don't know why that is. I don't feel like I'm a particularly sad person necessarily, but there was something moody and melancholy in that picture, more very vividly moody and melancholy. Soon as we would put the flash forwards in, everybody would shut up because they knew something terrible was going to happen by the end of the picture, because the flash forwards would come full circle with it in a way, and you would see there were little tiny things. You would see a scene, for example, where Robert, the character Robert, would get given the shirt with the sponsor's name on him that he was wearing in the flash forwards. So you say, wait a minute, it's getting closer, it's getting closer, it's getting closer, you know. Anyway, those were some of the, but also it was, as I said, it was a film that took place in one set only. There was no way to go outside, there was no way to do anything else. It was also a film that repeated the same activity over and over and over again for 2 hours and got slower, which is a nightmare. I mean, in order to make, to create the reality of the fatigue level, I had a real pacing problem. You can't make them talk faster. If anything, they're getting more and more sleepy, more and more tired. So there were some really disastrously difficult things to try to overcome on those levels. So those were some of the problems that we had.
Jane Fonda credits you with getting her out of her sex kitten image that she had gotten typed into at that point.
Yeah, she, Barbarella was just prior to, you know, she was films like that. They Shoot Horses Don't Think was the first really serious film that she made. And I think had the country not been as adamant politically as it was, or had her political stance not been what it was, she would have won the Academy Award that year. She was nominated, and she was just terribly unpopular in 1970. And it took her till the following year and Clute to win it. But she was an odds-on favorite from those Shoot Horses, Don't They?
How was your working relationship with her on the film?
Terrific. I mean, I love working with her. I worked with her again on Electric Horseman, and I love working with her. I mean, she's a different woman now than she was then, but just as professional, just as dedicated, just as serious, and just as rich to work with.
So, like I said, Blu-ray looks good. Special features include, and I think some of these are ported over from other releases, but it doesn't matter because they're great, an audio commentary with director Sidney Pollack, and he's excellent. You know, he's a thoughtful filmmaker, you know, somebody who is almost in that place where he takes himself too seriously, but not quite. Like, it's just at a place where he takes it seriously enough and gives a lot of insightful comments about the production and how they shot it and the difficulties of shooting in one space and shooting over a long period of time where people are supposed to get more tired, and how do you do that without slowing the movie down. It's a lot of interesting stuff, like I said. So very good commentary. And then there's another commentary with Jane Fonda, producer Irwin Winkler, producer Martin Baum, actress Bonnie Bedelia, actor Michael Sarrazin, actor Red Buttons, and hairstylist Sidney Glaroff. So that's a good track too. Jane Fonda dominates the front of that track, and that's really neat to hear her perspective on it and sort of her history coming into it. The movie definitely means a lot to her, rightfully so, because she does great work, and like I said, it was kind of a breakout. And then there's a making of featurette, which is also interesting too. But this is almost, this movie and the next movie are probably my picks of the week or of the month for Kino releases. Really great stuff. Please support Kino. They are doing good work, and they're making an effort with the extras, which I love. So next up is Love with a Proper Stranger from 1963.
Hi. Come on in.
Hi. Man, do you look wild.
Thank you.
No, I mean it. I really mean it. You look like a woman.
How can you manage to make even a compliment sound like a slap in the face?
Well, what did I say? You look like a woman. I apologize. Excuse me. You look like a man.
We had a long talk, and he came to me like a man, and he's willing to marry.
Sit down. The both of you. Do you want to get married?
Well, who wants to get married?
You mean, even though you don't want to marry me, you're willing to do it anyway?
Well, I'm just as much to blame as you are. I'm more. It was my fault, the whole thing, and I'm willing to take my medicine.
And I'm the medicine, right?
I just don't know what it is. Well, all you have to do is just look at me and...
I've got a man who wants to get married, and he wants to get married to me. And if I don't hear the bells and the banjos ringing every time I look at him, then I can just live without the bells and the banjos. Because I sure don't hear them when I look at you either.
Now wait.
No, get away from me. Just get away from me, please. Now I never want to see you again. Get out. Go. I mean it. Go. Go where the wind blows you.
Hey. Hey, come on, Angie. Let me in, will you?
So it says, newly remastered in HD. Two of Hollywood's all-time favorite stars heat up the steamy streets of Manhattan in this tough and tender romance. Taken for granted by her Catholic Italian family, innocent Macy's sales girl Angie Rossini, Natalie Wood, seeks solace in the arms of a charming and footloose jazz musician, Rocky Papasano, Steve McQueen. She becomes pregnant and doesn't expect Rocky to marry her. She just needs his help to raise the money for an illegal abortion, while her family pressures her to marry Gormless Anthony Colombo, Tom Bosley. This classic romantic comedy drama was directed by Robert Mulligan, summer 42, and produced by Alan J. Pakula. Mulligan also, of course, did To Kill a Mockingbird, and he did actually a bunch of other cool stuff. The Stalking Moon is a cool western with Gregory Peck. Nickel Ride is a cool crime movie. Baby the Rain Must Fall. There's a lot of good stuff here, but Love with the Proper Stranger is coming off of the success of To Kill a Mockingbird. And the movie really is a departure from that kind of thing. It says, written by Arnold Schulman, Goodbye Columbus, with top-notch cinematography by Milton R. Krasner, and a rousing score by Elmer Bernstein. I'll have to try and find some of that. Co-starring Edie Adams, Herschel Bernardi, and Harvey Lembeck, nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Actress for Wood, Best Screenplay, Cinematography, Art Direction, and Costume Design by the great Edith Head. So yeah, this is a really charming movie that I like very much and has not, to this point, really been available on home video outside of VHS. So another tip of the hat to Kino for bringing out a movie that has been missing from the home video space for quite some time. So, and it's great. I mean, it's early Steve McQueen. Natalie Wood is always stellar. McQueen is not quite the Steve McQueen he would become. He is a more innocent, kind of inexperienced is not the right word, but you can definitely feel him growing as an actor in a role like this. But yeah, it's got a great setup. You know, the very first scene is like this giant dance hall and Steve McQueen's in there and Natalie Wood wanders up to him and tells him, I'm pregnant.
You don't know who I am, do you?
Yeah, I was in a dance in Brooklyn this summer. In the mountains, right? It was a dance in the mountains. What do you mean I don't remember?
It doesn't matter. My name's Angela. Can I talk to you a minute? I'm on my lunch hour. I've only got a minute.
Sure, honey.
I'm gonna have a baby.
Congratulations.
Don't worry. I'm not gonna cause you any trouble. All I want from you is a doctor. An address, you know?
No, wait. Look, you just don't walk in a place like this and,
Oh, forget it.
Listen, yeah. You just don't walk up to a guy and tell him something like that. Finished. Now come on, and I'll buy you a coffee.
Look, I didn't think you'd give a damn one way or the other, but I did hope that you.
And that's like, you know, within the first 7 minutes of the movie. So right away, you've got a tone shifter. It's kind of like, whoa, what's the history behind this couple? And she then she's saying she needs money for this back alley abortion. So that's kind of a dark place for the movie to be. Yeah, it's solid stuff. So this was the third Oscar nomination for Natalie Wood after Rebel Without a Cause and Splendor in the Grass previously. Tom Bosley is good in it as this like nerdy restaurateur guy that the family likes.
Look, I better ask you what anyhow, the thing is that they are having this dance, you know, like a dance over at the Sons of Garibaldi. And I thought that, you probably got a date already, probably. This Saturday night?
This Saturday? Tomorrow night?
I knew it. Well, listen, it's, Okay. Well, good night, everybody.
Hey, where are you going? What?
What you hiding?
Well, you know, listen, with the kind of help you got to put up with these days, you know, you're out of business in a couple hours. I'll see you, Dan. Julie, it's good to see you, Mrs.
Yeah, come again soon, eh?
Listen, I'm sorry about...
That's okay. Next time. Listen, what are you doing New Year's Eve? It's only 9 months away. I'm kidding. I'm joking. It's a big joke, huh? I'm a big comedian. Well, listen, then. Good night, Angie.
Good night, Anthony.
The disc has a nice commentary track on it, and this is from Kat Ellinger, who is editor-in-chief of Diabolique magazine, and Sam Deegan, who is an associate editor at Diabolique, and both of them co-host a really neat podcast called Daughters of Darkness, which is a good genre-like horror podcast that you should totally check out. These ladies really know their stuff, and I do hope to hear more commentaries from them in the future. They were both on this podcast that I love called Supporting Characters, each in individual interviews, and you should definitely go check those out too if you want to hear two women who really know what they're talking about and just have great minds for taking films apart. And so the commentary is really good in that way, and they offer up some things that I hadn't even thought of, you know, comparisons to Italian neorealism. You know, they have a neat take on Steve McQueen's character being a version of James Dean's character from Rebel with a Cause, like 10 years later. Like, what would that guy be like? So there's a lot of really interesting and thoughtful analysis, and it's a great track. And I do like the trend of using podcasters, film podcasters, for commentaries. I just, you know, there's a lot of great people out there doing this kind of thing, and they are perfectly suited in the audio format to do a commentary. So again, kudos to Kino for seeking those people out. So that's a great disc. And like I said, hasn't really been available in a long time. Another of my picks for the month, for sure. Next up is a movie that more people will definitely know, and that's Barton Fink from 1991.
For the first time in the history of the Cannes Film Festival, one film has swept all the major awards. Barton Fink.
Welcome to Los Angeles, Mr. Fink.
Excuse me?
Howdy, neighbor.
Are you a writer, Mr. Fink?
Actually, I'm writing for the pictures now.
Oh, it's an exciting time, man.
Is that him? Is that Barton Fink?
Say whatever the hell you want. The writer is king here at Capitol Pictures. We're only interested in one thing. Can you tell a story, Bart? Can you make us laugh? Can you make us cry? Can you make us want to break out? Enjoy a song. Is that more than one thing? Okay.
Devil on the canvas, 12 apple, take one.
Just having trouble getting started.
Wallace Beery, wrestling picture. What do you need, a roadmap?
We all need understanding, Barton.
Oh, you'll lick this picture business. Believe me, you got a head on your shoulders. And what is it they say? Where there's a head, there's hope.
I'm sitting in the audience. The lights go down. Capitol logo comes up.
Hey,
LAPD.
Got some questions we want to ask you.
Sorry, I'm in trouble. Something horrible's happened.
Female Caucasian, about 30 years old. Ever seen Munt with anyone fits that description?
But, you know, with the head still on.
Well, Barton, you might say I saw peace of mind.
Right now, the contents of your head are the property of Capitol Pictures.
But Charlie, why me?
Because you don't listen!
I'm a writer.
Look upon me!
A new film by Joel and Ethan Coen.
So, you probably know Barton Fink, but here's what the back says. John Turturro shines in the lead role as Barton Fink, the Coen brothers' hilarious satire set in 1940s Hollywood. Barton Fink is a Broadway playwright who reluctantly relocates to Hollywood to write screenplays. Ordered to write a low-budget screenplay about wrestling, Fink manages to type one sentence and then nothing. Although his chatty insurance salesman neighbor, Charlie, John Goodman, helps out by teaching Barton about wrestling, the clock ticks, the temperature rises, and Barton's life spins more and more out of control. Top-notch cast includes Judy Davis, Michael Lerner, John Mahoney, Tony Shalhoub, John Polito, and Steve Buscemi, with a hauntingly beautiful score by Carter Burwell and gorgeous cinematography by Roger Deakins. Now, this was actually the first collaboration between the Coens and Roger Deakins, I believe. So one of the great director-cinematographer combos out there. And you can definitely see how Roger Deakins is always good. And so this movie is really helped by what he brings to it. Received 3 1991 Oscar nominations, Best Supporting Actor, Michael Lerner, Art Direction, and Costume Design. Also won Best Actor, Totoro, and Best Director, Joel Coen, as well as the coveted Palme d'Or at Cannes that year. So yeah, this movie is still one of my favorite Coen Brothers movies, and it's still one of their strangest movies. I remember when I first saw it, I was taken aback by it at the time, as it was kind of out there and still is. Even though they had weird sort of surrealism in their films before, this one was more dramatic, like art house weird, with less comedy. I don't know if I'd call it a hilarious comedy. It definitely has some funny moments for sure, but overall there's a sense of sort of doom and dread about the movie that I love. I don't know if I'd call it hilarious. I mean, like I said, their work is inherently comedic. There's just stuff that makes you laugh sewn through it in all different ways. But yeah, this one just, I don't know. I didn't expect to like a movie like this back when I first saw it. It was like Sunset Boulevard by way of Eraserhead or something. And though I liked both those movies, I think actually after 1991, I don't know that I'd seen both those movies in 1991. I might have seen Eraserhead. Even though I like both those movies, this sort of art house thing was not my bag back then. I was, you know, still in high school, and so I just wasn't open enough to appreciate a lot of films along these lines, but this one I did. I really did. It was a big deal to me, too, because it was such a challenging and strange movie, and I wasn't even fully sure that, like, I got the movie back then, and that kind of thing often made me uncomfortable. If I felt like I didn't get a movie, I couldn't really like it. But this was a total exception. I just was like, there's something amazing going on here, and it's thought-provoking and messed up, but just really stuck with me, and it still does.
Joel, first of all, how did Barton Fink come about? Because I gather that you wrote it when you were actually supposed to be writing Miller's Crossing.
Well, that's true, actually. We were in the middle of writing the script for Miller's Crossing and had sort of hit a snag. I wouldn't call it writer's block. That's a little too dramatic a description, I think. But we had sort of hit a wall with the script, and we were having trouble with the plot and decided to think about something else just as a sort of relief from that problem, really. Yeah, the writer's block was certainly sort of the catalyst for the story.
So apart from writer's block, what came first? Is it the story? Was it Hollywood? Was it the characters? Or was it that truly ghastly hotel you created? But what was the most important focal thing to start with?
It's always hard to remember in retrospect what came first, because actually it all starts as a bunch of nebulous ideas, some of which sort of fall by the wayside and some of which for whatever reason sort of seem to want to stick together, and that's what we draw the story from. It definitely wasn't Hollywood. I mean, we were thinking about the ghastly, derelict old sort of ghost ship hotel before we knew exactly where we'd place it. And I guess it was that, for whatever reasons, that sort of visual idea appealed to us.
We wanted the hotel to be another character in the movie in a certain respect. And we spent a lot of time with Dennis Gassner, the designer, sort of working out the details of that, because it seemed like it was a sort of a central image and an important sort of aspect of the whole story.
Where did Barton Fink himself come from? Because, I mean, curiously enough, he looks a bit like you two. But, I mean, and he's a terribly earnest and pretentious young man. And I'm sure you're not.
Well,
like
there
that,
you but, have it.
Or, you're earnest and he's pretentious. Or is it the other way around?
We argue about that. We go back and forth on that.
But he's based, is he not, on Clifford Odets?
Well, he's...
A bit.
Right, a bit. Rather superficially. I mean, his background resembles Odette's background in that he's sort of a New York playwright from a sort of group theater background, sort of social realist background, you know, celebrating the common man as Odette's did. But in terms of what he's like personally, I mean, I don't know much about Odets, but I suspect that he's nothing like our main character, and is certainly his sojourn in Hollywood was, again, nothing like the main character's.
There is actually one instance in the movie that involves the studio head that that is drawn from real life, which is the at the end of the movie you see the studio head wearing a colonel's uniform, which is something that Jack Warner did. He had himself commissioned a colonel in the Army and had the wardrobe department at Warner Brothers make him a uniform. The rest of it's made up, but it's all sort of hopefully in the sort of accurate in terms of the spirit of the behavior of a lot of these guys.
And indeed, I mean, that's why we did, you know, settle on the Hollywood background. We wanted something that would be a totally unnerving and unreal for the main character so that he'd sort of have no sort of
foothold in reality.
Yeah, no sort of haven except this guy next door whom he assumes to be, you know, normalcy itself.
The Goodman character is another way in which you turn everything on its head, because at the beginning, this is the good old John Goodman that we know from Roseanne and lots of other movies, but he's not quite like that after all, is he?
Right, ends up being not quite like that at all. Actually, I think that's a great part of what appealed to John Goodman about playing the character, that he was, that he did get to do something a little bit out of the ordinary for him, for what generally he gets offered, I think.
Well, one of the many things that are fascinating about Barton Fink is the way it starts off as a kind of satire on Hollywood and intellectual pretensions, and then all of a sudden it moves off in a quite sinister way. Did you have that in mind at the very beginning, or did that just happen as you wrote?
Actually, no, we had that in mind in sort of broad outline from the if not from the beginning, near the very beginning. We knew that at a certain point in the movie, midway through or two-thirds of the way through, we would have it take that sort of dark turn. I mean, it was part of the program of the movie as a whole to sort of yank the rug out from under the main character's feet, Barton Fink's feet, and along with his, the audience's, and sort of not let them know quite where they stood along with the main character.
We still wanted there to be a little bit of a thread, as Ethan said, underneath the comedy, so that when the tone changes radically, as it does midway through, the audience was a little bit prepared. They should be surprised, but a little bit prepared for it.
Well, throughout this, every time you answer a question, it's been we. I mean, you work very, very closely together, don't you? I mean, how do you divide the work? And you, Ethan, produce, Joel directs. Mm.
Yeah,
does that overlap at times?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, actually, it's more than overlaps. Actually, the answer to the question is we don't divide it up much at all. I mean, it starts out, we write the script together, and that's like entirely collaborative process. We don't like split up scenes at all, and each do one, another do the other. We just sort of, both the two of us, talk a scene back and forth. And it proceeds pretty much like that. I mean, to tell you the truth, there isn't much division of labor at all.
We're both on the set the entire time when we're shooting. We're both there for every shot, essentially, behind the camera. After every shot, we both talk to the technicians and the actors. It's really, the movie's essentially co-directed. All the creative decisions that sort of go into directing a movie are really mutual decisions.
Well, your films tend to have a kind of cult following so far, don't they? Which I'm sure, well, I know is growing. But they don't, or at least I don't think so far, you've had a big financial success with any of the four.
Yeah.
Does that bother you at all, or are you happy with a sort of growing cult status?
Well, no, I mean, you'd always prefer more people see the movie than less. So they've all been, except for Miller's Crossing, which, I mean, the reasons are always a mystery, which didn't do well at all. They've all been sort of middling, moderate successes given how cheaply they were made. I mean, all of our movies have actually, by Hollywood standards, been quite inexpensive. But, yeah, geez, I mean, certainly more people would be better, not worse.
And it was a revelation for me in terms of John Goodman, because I was used to him on, I think, Roseanne, and he had done dramatic films prior to this, like Sea of Love and Punchline, but this movie just made me go, whoa, John Goodman is freaking amazing. And by the way, he also did King Ralph the same year.
He's a king in love.
You're not the kind of girl I'm used to. You can spell, you wear clothes to work.
And I'm not slagging off King Ralph, but there's a wide gap between the two films, and that says something about his abilities, I think. And Michael Lerner, who plays like a studio head, is just amazing.
Now, people are going to say to you, Wallace Beery, wrestling, it's a B picture. You tell them, bullshit! We do not make B pictures here at Capitol. Let's put a stop to that rumor right now.
He's one of my favorite character actors ever, and he just kills it in this movie. It is a fascinating watch, and I'm so glad that Kino put it out. And it's a nice special edition, too. It has over an hour's worth of interviews, including a new interview with John Turturro, which is 15 minutes, a new interview with Michael Lerner, which is 16 minutes, and this was great. Since I said I love Lerner, he did not disappoint, and this is maybe one of my favorite supplements on any disc this year. He swears a lot during this interview. He also talks about being a fan of Ernst Lubitsch and Preston Sturges, and he says his favorite actor is Edward G. Robinson, all of which is awesome. But his take on acting and the movie and everything is great too. Good stuff. I loved it. There's also a new interview with executive producer Ben Barinholtz. That's 12 minutes. And then something called Headspace, The Inner Sounds of Barton Fink, which is an interview with composer Carter Burwell and supervising sound editor Skip Livesey. That's 20 minutes. And that's definitely something I should mention about the movie that I love, is that it has great sound design. And the hotel where Barton stays especially has all kinds of great things about it. The production design is obviously amazing. It's this old hotel, but there's all these things that they do with sound, you know, sound from like a creaky old fan in the elevator or the wallpaper peeling off the wall. There's just so many things that they do with it that makes the movie that much more surreal. I mean, you get a sense of it right away when Barton goes to the front desk of the hotel and rings the bell, and it like resonates for a really long time. It just rings out in the empty space of like the lobby. You're just like, oh, okay, they're definitely doing something with sound here. And so that sort of stylization elevates everything. And I do love that about it. And I had forgotten that that was a big part of why I love the movie. So anyway, great disc, looks good. It's got 8 deleted scenes on top of those interviews. It's a good special edition. Coen Brothers fans, there's no excuse. Pick it up. Next up, I have one called Pritzi's Honor, and this is from 1985.
For Charlie Partena and Irene Walker, it was love at first sight.
Hey.
They discovered they had the same taste in clothing.
A coat like this will stand out in New York, you know.
The same fiery passion.
Kiss me, Charlie.
Public.
And then they discovered they had the same line of work.
I do the job on you, boom. Dump you in a hole and cover it up.
I've been doing 3-4 hits a year for the last few years, most of them full pay.
That many?
Well, it's not many if you consider the size of the population.
But in the Pritzi family,
I'm gonna move Dominic out to Vegas and make you boss.
It's always dangerous.
Are you the contractor?
Who is it?
Brooklyn fella, Charlie Partena.
To mix pleasure with business.
I go looking for the bad guy and it turns out to be my woman. Can you imagine this? Do I ice her? Do I marry her? Which one of these?
But yeah, let's play doctor.
You're not a cookie, my dear.
Pritzi's Honor.
Now Gene and I are going to review our individual choices for the year's best films, going through our entire list bottom to top. And my 10th place film is Blood Simple, one of the year's most ingenious and blood-curdling thrillers. In ninth place, Streetwise, the heartbreaking documentary about young kids growing up on the streets of Seattle. Number 8, Lost in America, Albert Brooks' comedy about the American dream of success. Seventh place, Mad Max, Beyond Thunderdome, a great-looking, high-style thriller, the best of the Road Warrior movies. Number 6, Witness, with Harrison Ford as a cop who lives among the Amish community. Number 5, Ran, Akira Kurosawa's movie about the King Lear legend. Number 4, Pritzi's Honor, the John Huston film with those great Jack Nicholson and Kathleen Turner performances. Number 3, The Falcon and the Snowman, with two more great performances by Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn. And in second place, Martin Scorsese's hard-edged comedy of big city life, After Hours. And of course, my choice for the top film on the list, Steven Spielberg's wonderful heartfelt drama, The Color Purple.
The back says, hired killers by day, devoted lovers by night. Charlie Partena, Jack Nicholson, a do-it-yourself kind of guy, has been loyal to the family since he can remember. If you need somebody rubbed out, he's your eraser, ready to kill at the drop of a dime. The mafia's boss daughter, Angelica Houston, has eyes for Charlie, but Charlie has just married the sultry hired assassin named Irene Walker, Kathleen Turner. Their unlikely relationship hits a snag, however, as they find out their next job is to ice each other. Now Charlie must choose which contract to honor, the one to his wife or the one on his wife. Legendary filmmaker John Huston directed this wickedly amoral killer comedy with a top-notch cast that includes Robert Loggia, William Hickey, John Randolph, and Lawrence Tierney. Winner of 1986 Oscar for Supporting Actress for Angelica Houston. And she, here's her giving her speech.
And the winner is Angelica Houston and Cookie Bonner. I'd like to thank the members of the Academy for honoring my fellow nominees and myself. This means a lot to me, since it comes from a role in which I was directed by my father. And I know it means a lot to him.
And here she talks about her dad on Charlie Rose.
What was your relationship with him? I mean, were you close?
Were they
up and down? Did it depend on the year?
We were many ways. He was exacting as a father. And I think he loved his children enormously. But he was also demanding. He was also away a lot, which meant that in his rather long absences, we'd grow. Sometimes, particularly in the sort of adolescent years, I think he was shocked by some of the developments, and could be scary, and often took one to task in those years, because I don't know how happy he was really at that time. And so I grew up in love and fear of my father, but I adored him, and I wanted his approval. But failing to get his approval, I think I was probably rebellious and difficult.
Difficult for him.
Later on, it changed, particularly around the time of Preetzi's Honor, because I had the good sense finally to learn my craft, which was helpful around him, because he didn't suffer fools lightly, and I think he preferred what was adult and children to what was childish in children.
So this is a good movie. Again, maybe this one's a little more comedic than dramatic, but I feel like there's definitely a good deal of drama in it as well. It's interesting to see Nicholson in this very New York kind of like... He's very New York in this. The accent is full-on blue-collar New York, and it's almost silly. When you heard him in the trailer, you probably got a sense of what I'm talking about. So that takes a little getting used to, but he and Kathleen Turner are really good together in here. This is when she was in her prime. It is based on a novel by Richard Condon, who wrote his own script with Janet Roach. It's just a good movie. Angelica Houston, also great. And obviously, like I said, she won the Academy Award. She and Jack Nicholson were a couple on and off for like more than 17 years. I don't know if they were still together when this... I think they were apart when this came out. But anyway, it's a great latter-day Houston movie. Maybe his last great movie. I mean, I'm not saying he made a lot of bad movies in the later part of his career, but this is one that definitely is solid and has been a little bit forgotten, mostly because it hasn't been on Blu-ray yet. So the special features include an audio commentary by film historians Howard S. Berger and Nathaniel Thompson. And these guys have done several commentaries for Kino before, both very knowledgeable, and it's a good track. Transfer looks good. Definitely worth picking up. Okay, and then lastly, I have a movie called The Birthday Party from 1968.
Who is it?
Two gentlemen.
What two gentlemen?
The ones that were coming. I just took them to their room. They were thrilled with their room.
They've come?
They're very nice, Stan.
Why didn't they come last night?
They said the beds were wonderful.
Who are they?
They're very nice, Stan.
I said, who are they?
I told you, the two gentlemen.
I didn't think they'd come.
They have. They were here when I came in.
What do they want here?
They want to stay.
How long for?
They didn't say.
But why here? Why not somewhere else?
This house is on the list.
What are they called? What are their names?
Oh, Stanley, I can't remember.
They told you, didn't they? Or didn't they tell you?
Yes, they...
Then what are they? Come on, try to remember.
Why, Stan, do you know them?
How do I know if I know them until I know their names?
Well, told me, I remember.
Well?
Gold something.
Gold something?
Yes. Gold?
Yes.
Goldberg. That's right, that was one of them. You know them? Stan, they won't wake you up, I promise. I'll tell them they must be quiet. They won't be here long, Stan. I still bring you up your early morning tea. You mustn't be sad today. It's your birthday.
Hmm?
It's your birthday, Stan. I was going to keep it a secret until tonight.
No.
It is. I've brought you a present.
Now, this is a William Friedkin movie. Before he made The French Connection, before he broke out in the 70s, this is one of the films he made. And it says, the birthday party was originally presented on stage in London in 1958. Legendary playwright Harold Pinter became an overnight sensation and is now recognized as one of the greatest talents in contemporary English literature. The birthday party has been described as a comedy of menace, a dramatic expose of contemporary man's inability to cope with his fears and guilt. The story centers around a shabby seaside boarding house in England where a seemingly inane and trivial conversation suddenly transforms from humorous to terrifying. The third feature film, directed by the great William Friedkin, stars Robert Shaw and Patrick McGee. So this is G-rated, which is really interesting to me. It was before they did PG, I think. I don't know, even. But really interesting movie. Great performances by Shaw and McGee. And I think if you're used to Robert Shaw from, like, Jaws or, I don't know, from Rush with Love or something, this is definitely worth a look because you get more of a sense of how great an actor he is. I mean, I guess anything he's in exemplifies that. But I do like these stripped-down movies where an actor is just really the driving force behind it. You know, it's not about special effects or sets or set pieces. It's just about the acting and the writing. And obviously Harold Pinter, one of the greats, as Friedkin describes here.
Let's start with Pinter, one of the great writers of the 20th century.
Oh yeah, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
So here you are. This is your third film now, if I'm right about this. You did Minsky's.
Yes, The Birthday Party, which Pinter wrote originally as a play and then adapted as a film script, was my third film.
So how do you deal? Let's start with, you know, you're still a new filmmaker.
Communication, and to be specific, I mean, I love Pinter, and I learned a great deal from him. And it took me up several notches in terms of my understanding of the world, working with Pinter for a year on The Birthday Party in England. And there was this rumor that you could not change a word of Pinter's script. And I understood why, because it's written in a kind of blank verse poetry.
And you see it on Broadway or to get inspired?
It wasn't on Broadway. No, I saw it at a workshop in San Francisco, and I thought it was just stunning. And so I wrote to him and I said, look, I have these movie studios that want to make little films with me and I'd like to do The Birthday Party. He said, come on over. And we met. He was very young and I was 10 years younger. And he said, okay, we'll do it. And we cast it with a great British cast of that, Robert Shaw and Patrick McGee. And what it is about is irrational fear. Irrational fear and paranoia. And there's a scene in it where this character played by Robert Shaw is in a seaside resort, out of the way and cheap, in a boarding house, and he's hiding from something or someone. And two guys come in to the resort out of nowhere, an Irishman and a Jew. It's almost like a joke. An Irishman and a Jew walk into a resort. And it turns out that these two guys are looking for this Robert Shaw character. We don't know why. We never know why. But it's part of the idea that paranoia becomes real. And they go from a kind of polite conversation at one point with him, where they're sitting alone in the living room, and it becomes an interrogation that's terrifying. And they ask him questions that he can't answer and has no way of answering, and they break him down at the end of the scene. And Patrick McGee, who was a scholar as well as a great actor, a lot of Samuel Beckett's plays were written for Patrick McGee, who first performed them. And McGee had been in an original production of The Birthday Party in England. And Pinter used to come to rehearsals, but this one day he didn't come to the rehearsal of the interrogation scene. And McGee was saying to me it was a shame because when Pinter first wrote the play, there were two references in it that had to be cut out of the play because they had the Lord Chamberlain's office in England, which was a kind of censor board that would delete any reference from a play or a film that had to do either with the monarchy, this was in the 50s, with the monarchy or the church. And he said there are two lines that Pinter had written that the Lord Chamberlain had cut. And they were questions, one by the Jewish guy, the other by the Irish guy. And the questions were, who hammered the nails? And the other guy said, who drove in the screws? And these were obviously a reference to the crucifixion. I said to McGee, those lines were originally in the play? He said, yeah, and had to be cut. So that evening, I called Pinter at home, and I said, McGee told me about those two lines that you cut. He said, what are you talking about? I told him the lines. He said, I never wrote those lines. He said, McGee is hallucinating. He said, McGee thinks more about my work than I do, and he's hallucinating. I never wrote those lines. I said, oh, Jesus. And Harold said, wait. He said, look, do you have a few minutes? Yeah. He said, stay on the phone. I'm going to go upstairs. He lived in one of those five-story Nash townhouses in Regent's Park. And he said, stay on the phone, and I'm going to go up to my office, and I'm going to find my original type script of the birthday party. So he goes up. It must have been 15 minutes. I'm waiting on the phone, and he comes back down. He says, I have this script here. It has all of my pencil changes, cuts, additions. He said, those lines were never in the play. This is my original type script. I said, oh, no. He said, what's the matter? I said, well, I just think they're great. He said, you like those lines? I said, I think they're fantastic. He said, well, put them in. And this was Pinter, whose reputation was, you cannot change a word. Then later, we're sitting around at another rehearsal, and McGee said to him, there's a reference also to an event that took place in the Christian faith centuries ago, and Pinter referred to it as the Albigensian heresy. And McGee said, look, Harold, now that we're filming the definitive version of this play, why don't you get the reference right? It's the Albigensianist heresy, not the Albigensian heresy. And Pinter said, well, look, it's been like that for 8 years. Let's just leave it alone. So that he didn't change for accuracy. The other he changed because I guess he thought those were good lines too, even if McGee made them up. So what you find is that even someone with a unique voice and a genius like Harold Pinter has a way of working that is almost prohibitive. You can't enter the temple unless you're willing to play by the rules. But even Pinter is open to those doors letting in air and ideas coming from the outside, which is very important as part of communication for a director. You have to listen to all the voices that may come in from the outside.
So, really cool movie, and definitely one that I feel like people have not seen. A lot of people have not seen. You know, if you're a Friedkin fan, do yourself a favor. It's definitely worth your time. The special features include an interview with director William Friedkin, which is great. Yeah, overall, good disc. I'm really happy that this is part of this month's offerings from Kino. Again, just really kind of killing it as far as finding great and interesting titles, lesser known stuff that cinephiles will appreciate. I just think they're really kicking a lot of butt. So please support them. Please check out their stuff and keep an eye on the KL Studio Classics Twitter feed for announcements. They also have a Facebook page, Kino Lorber Studio Classics, where you'll get to see every week they're announcing new titles. You know, so there's definitely something that'll catch your eye at some point, whether it's an older movie or something like Space Camp, which is coming really soon. You know, I mean, they've got an interesting range of stuff going, and I'm a huge fan of theirs, and you should be too. So thank you so much for listening. That is it for this episode. Have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week, and I will speak with you very soon. Bye-bye.
I could fall in love with the proper stranger. If I heard the bells and the banjos ring, if two certain eyes with the look of danger.